Hi everyone, welcome to a special interview episode of Legends of the Old West. If you're listening to this right after it's been released, we're just a few short days from the premiere of our new show, Infamous America. It starts in October with Season 1, Salem, a show that will tell the story of the Salem witch trials. And many of you have probably seen the name Black Barrel Media associated with this show or on social media. My sister and I teamed up to form a company to produce audio and video content, and it will be the home for Legends of the Old West and Infamous America. The Legends website and social media channels will all still be active. We're still going to keep posting everything related to this show on those pages. That won't change. But from now on, OldWestPodcast.com will redirect you to our company's website, BlackBarrelMedia.com. Head over there and check it out. It'll be your one-stop shop for information about the shows and the videos we've produced and everything else. That's where you want to go from now on. But all right, at this moment, you're here to listen to Craig Johnson, author of the Walt Longmire Mysteries. Craig's books are fixtures on the New York Times bestseller list, and his new novel, Depth of Winter, is no exception. Those of you who have been longtime listeners will know that I spoke to Craig over the summer, so this is a fun follow-up to that interview. He spent the month of September touring the country to promote his book, and I caught up with him in Scottsdale, Arizona. We talked about the annual event Longmire Days and what it's like to be on a book tour, and of course, Depth of Winter. Here's Craig Johnson.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
So, Craig, thank you again. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for doing a second interview with us in, what, 3 months, I guess?
It is.
Like that. I think, yeah, we met, of course, in Billings, Montana at the Western Writers of America convention. As I just showed you, I'm using my little Western Writers of America booklet.
You are.
Got all my notes here ready to go.
You drank the Kool-Aid and everything,
yeah,
didn't you?
All of it. Yeah, it was quite tasty, so I brought some more along with me here today. Let me address the new listeners real quick. So we've recruited a lot of new listeners over the summer as the show's been growing. So anyone who has not heard the first interview that I did with Craig, it was a July issue. So we're kind of following up on that. In that interview, you gave us a great tease of The Depth of Winter, which you are now out on tour promoting.
I am.
So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And so we have some limitations for what we're going to talk about, but we probably will get into a few spoilers down the road in this podcast. For you listeners who are hearing this and you're big fans, I will give you a warning. You will be warned when the spoilers
You will hear
come.
A noise. You'll
exactly.
hear a noise.
There will be big sirens and bells.
So coyotes howling. And
exactly. So you know when to pause it and when to come back to us when we get to that point. But for right now, we're here in Scottsdale, Arizona, and you are just a couple days into your book tour to support the new book. We're at the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. It's a great little place. If you've ever been in here, any of you Arizona fans, you can come in. You can see all the pictures of the authors on the wall as I look at them right now. Everybody has stopped through here. You've been here probably a couple times, haven't you?
Oh, geez. I've been here since the very first book,
yeah,
Cold Dish, like
that's
back
right.
in 05. Like, so, yeah, every year. Yeah,
you're a veteran. This is one of the stops on the tour.
Okay, well, this is a big deal. This is probably, if you were to pick out, probably one of the most powerful and astute mystery bookstores, probably in the world. I think, this one certainly has to give everybody else a run for their money.
Yeah, certainly. If anyone lives in the Phoenix area, if you're stopping through Phoenix, if you're in the Scottsdale area, come check it out. It's a great little independent bookstore. There are few and far between anymore, so this is a proud little independent bookstore. Please come by and check it out. So the first thing we wanted to say, before we even dive into the tours, I want to hear a little bit about the tour, but since we last saw you, my sister and I really wanted to try to get to Longmire Day in August, and we could not make it. We were buried in our production schedule. We tried. We looked at the flights. We tried to pull it off. We couldn't do it. So tell me about Longmire Days. How was the event this
year? Well, first off, don't worry about it because it happens every year.
Yes, like we're already planning for next year.
And yeah, it's even though, you know, like we're streaming the six seasons of the television show on Netflix, the books are still going great like that. And the town of Buffalo is wholly behind the idea of like continuing to do Longmire Days. And I'm happy to do it. I'm going to write these books, you know, until I fall over the computer, like that, or whatever I happen to be writing on in 20 or 30 years, like that. And then Robert Taylor said he's going to keep doing Longmire Days if they have to wheel him out in a wheelchair.
Awesome.
So he's game. So don't worry about it. It'll be fine. Like that. Yeah, it was incredible this year. It really, really was. Like it. I mean, you always think it's going to kind of slack off a little bit, maybe be not quite so big as it was. Like it, but it just gets bigger and bigger every year. Like that. And maybe a little smoother every year. Whenever you've got a town of about 4,500 people that's, you know, trying to host, you know, something of the scope, you know, of Longmire Days, you know, which is you know, all those TV personas, you know, and then like, you know, 15 to 20,000 people, you know, show up. And it's amazing. Like it really is. Like that, it's not more of a disaster, you know, than it is. Like it, and I mean that in the most you know, charming of senses. Like that, it's kind of nice. Like that, because you know, everybody's really extraordinarily well behaved for a crowd that size. And it's funny like that, because every year the sheriff and the chief of police for Buffalo come out and do a crime report every week, you know, after, you know, Longmire Days. Look at, and you know, the thing they're always amazed by is that, you know, we have 20,000 extra people in town and there's no extra crime. Nothing happens. Like it. And I'm like, well, you know, these are all people whose hero is a sheriff, you know. So, you know, they're it's not like Sturgis or anything, you know. It's actually a pretty well-behaved group like that. And you know, hey, this year was fantastic. Like it had you know, I think the charitable auction like that made something like $43,000 at the Occidental Hotel, and the Fergs motorcycle ride made close to $9,000, you know, for the animal shelter there in Buffalo.
Oh, my gosh.
We always try and break it up a little bit so that you have a national charity like that, and then a local charity,
sure,
you know, so we can kind of make it beneficial for all parties like that. But we had a really great group of actors that were there, just about everybody, you know, from the cast.
Yeah.
And they were great. It was, everybody had a wonderful time.
Fantastic. Yeah, I was going to say that I know A. Martinez was there, and thank you for the introduction in Billings. Well, he was there. I'm pretty sure he was there this time around, wasn't he?
He was. Oh, yeah.
We've kept in touch with him since you introduced him, since we did an interview, again, for any new listeners, right after Craig's episode in our series is an interview with A. Martinez. And he's a fantastic guy. So we've kept in touch with him. We're talking to him about
he's just an extraordinary human being. Yeah. Just an amazing individual like that. And, you know, to have the pedigree, you know, that he has, you know, in Westerns, for gosh sakes. I mean, you know, one of the first big movies he ever did was with John Wayne,
the Cowboys,
for goodness sake. Like that. And, you know, I think he was what? He was six when he was in that movie, wasn't he?
It feels like it.
I don't know. He went maybe 12. I don't know. We'll give him a little bit.
Incredible.
But yeah, he's just an extraordinary individual like that. And you know, we got an amazing group of people like that. I mean, you know, the show, you know, it's got its six seasons. It's streaming on Netflix now like that. But I mean, I think the cast is extraordinarily close knit. And it was a unique kind of show for them to be involved with. I mean, I'm going to be doing like an event up in Pueblo, a city read for Pueblo. Pueblo Reads the Cold Dish, first book in the Walt Longmire series. And lo and behold, I was surprised like that. I got an email message, you know, from Lou Diamond Phillips, and he says, I'm going to be there. I'm going to fly in like it and do the read with you. And I was like, wow, you know? And I mean, that's the kind of people they are. Like that. I mean, they just, you know, we really kind of stumbled onto an amazing cast.
Yeah, it's incredible that the books led to that TV show.
Mm-hmm.
That the cast became so close, and it's all been infused and intertwined
with each other.
Everyone is sticking together.
Mm-hmm.
After the show is finished, but the books are obviously still going.
Yep.
Everyone still feels a part of it. That's
incredible. Yeah. This kind of thing just doesn't happen
often. No. So I can't think of another example off the top of my head. I'll have to really start searching my memory to see if something like this, find an equivalent, but I can't think of one at the moment. So great. We will certainly plan on it, and I guess I have a new goal for next year, which is to learn how to ride a motorcycle so I can go on the ride with Ferg if he does it again.
You can go on the horseback ride too.
I don't need to renew my license for that one. So you are on a book tour. So tell me about a book tour. How does your schedule work? You were running around like a madman, crisscrossing the country. by the time people actually hear this interview, it's a couple with me a couple weeks after we're recording it. You will be on the other side of the country by that point.
Oh, yeah.
Getting close to the end. So
yeah.
What's the routine like, and what are the events that you do at some of the stops?
Oh, I mean, you know, we just finished one just last night up in Denver at the Lone Tree Event Center. Like that was like, I think it was 478 people, I think. You know, it was just an incredible event. Like that, and, you know, the books, you know, have gotten a lot more traction. I mean, after 14 years of, you know, of books, like getting, you know, in 10 years, you know, on the New York Times bestsellers list, and then 6 years of a television show certainly doesn't hurt at all. Like, but you know, to have all of these things happening, I mean, you know, the big thing is used to, I think it's, you know, the publishing industry's changed a lot. I mean, over the years. And, you know, used to, the, everybody, that's what they did. Like, they would take authors and they would send them out and have them do book tours is what they did. Like that. And then, you know, it kind of became, I think, financially prohibitive, like, you know, a lot of times, you know. And also you're up against a lot of competition out there, you know, to try and get people into bookstores to actually, you know, and hear and, you know, and have, you know, writers read their work and that type of thing. It's a little bit more difficult these days, like that. And so I'm extremely fortunate, like, that the publisher that I've got, you know, is just a strong believer that, you know, if I'm out there, I'm going to sell books, you know, and so they've always been, you know, kind of pushed, you know, for, you know, larger scale tours. And, you know, I guess, you know, I kind of pushed for it too, because I got to be honest, I mean, when they first started touring me, it was funny like that, because I would get all of these emails from little bookstores up in Montana and Idaho, Washington, Oregon, Utah, and they would write me and they would say, when is Viking Penguin going to send you to Baker City, Oregon? And I'd have to write them back and go, never, they're never going to do that. Like, and, you know, because what they're always trying to do is they're always trying to get you into the largest demographics possible, so they can get the largest amount of sales possible to get you further up on the New York Times bestsellers list as quick as possible. And so, you know, Wyoming, Montana, you know, Idaho, Utah, we're not high on that demographic list. Like, so what I'd do is I would tell them, you know, well, I'll tell you what, I'll gather up your information, I'll put it in a file, and then if I get a chance and I'm in the area or something, I'll try and set something up with you. Like that. Well, you know, a couple of years go by, like that, and I had this old motorcycle that I'd bought back in 1996. And I had that thing, and it got about 80 miles of the gallon. And I thought, you know what, if you took off on that thing, you could do a great big 5,000-mile loop all the way up through Montana, Idaho, Washington, Oregon, Utah, and swing back around into Wyoming. And, you know, it gets 80 miles of the gallon. Like, if I can find enough sofas, you know, to surf on, like that, this would be pretty good to do. Like, and so it started out, like, with about maybe, I think, about a half a dozen bookstores the first year that I did it. And by the time that I finally had to quit doing it, I think it was close to 30 bookstores that I was hitting in that motorcycle tour.
You basically made up your own motorcycle
tour. I did. Yeah. Like that. And I think, you know, I think Viking Penguin also noticed, you know, that had a large scale effect, you know, because we're in the Pacific Northwest bestsellers list year after year after year. And they started thinking, you know, we sell books when Craig is out on the road, you know, so maybe we should send him out on the road.
Should do this formally. Yeah. This should be a real thing that we do.
And so, you know, they did. Like, as a matter of fact, there was even one of the executives there at Viking Penguin and says, is there any way you think we could get him out on the road and have him do like a, maybe four different motorcycle tours, like on the four different sections? And finally, I think Catherine Court, the president of Penguin, said, we do need to give him enough time to go home and write every once in a while.
He needs to keep producing the books to support the tour. It's kind of
exactly.
A
it's a vicious, it. Vicious circle is what it is.
For sure. Well, actually, maybe think about it, too, that before, I think, were you basically home for the summer? I know you were in Europe in the spring.
Yeah.
And now you're on the road here.
Yeah.
Did you get to finally have some time to just write at home and relax a little bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, whenever I'm at the ranch, that's always going to be the priority, like, is to be able to write. I mean, you know, because that's what I do. That's what I really love doing. It's what I enjoy doing. It's always funny because I'll be talking to, like, workshops, you know, with, you know, would-be writers like that, you know, and they're always like, well, what's it like to go out and have a beer with Lou Diamond Phillips? And what's it like to, you know, have a book tour in France and all this? And I'm always looking at them and going, you do know that's like 3% of my life, right? The other 97% is, like, at my ranch, sitting in a room by myself, typing about my imaginary friends, okay? Yeah. And so, you know, it's a little bit, you know, different from what people think. Maybe not quite so romantic as they might think. But yeah, I had plenty of time to write this summer.
Like, as opposed to train stations and
books,
and terminals.
Oh, absolutely.
I remember you saying you've had to almost teach yourself how to write in those environments. But now, hopefully, you had the summer to relax and, you know, we'll all find out what's coming up next for Walt.
Well, you think it's precious, you know, and you think you have to sit in your chair and your desk with your mug of coffee looking out your window. And you get past that after a while.
Yep, I totally understand. All right, so at this point, we are going to transition and talk a little bit about The Depth of Winter.
Okay.
So anyone who's listening, if you haven't read, we're not going to get too deep into the details and too deep into the spoilers, but we are going to talk about a few things, a few points that happened. So if you have not read the book yet, please pause and come back to us when you're done. We'll be here waiting for you. But for the time being, we're going to move on and talk about depth of winter. So I typically think it's best to begin at the beginning. So we'll start right off the bat with when we first spoke, you decided that this was the book that was going to be the confrontation between Walt and the character of Tomas Bedard, his kind of nemesis, the most evil character of the series so far.
Yeah.
What made this the right time to bring that confrontation to it?
Well, you know, it actually, you know, I mean, these confrontations started like at the, you know, conflict between these two individuals started like in Serpent's Tooth, like that, which was about five novels back.
Right.
And, you know, I wanted to try and see what would happen, you know, with having a, you know, an arc of conflict that would go further, you know, than just one novel,
sure.
You know, because that's actually one of the hard parts about, you know, whenever you're writing murder mysteries like that, or, you know, crime fiction or whatever you want to call it. You come up with these, you know, really, really interesting antagonists, you know, and you develop, you know, backgrounds for them like that and develop them. And then
right.
you work so hard to make them and then they're dead by the time the book is over. Like, and so you yeah. lose them, you know. And so, you know, I thought, well, what would happen if maybe I can, like, you know, get this arc, maybe just go with a longer arc for this particular character like that and see what can happen to it. And also, you know, Walt, you know, is pretty much, you know, I mean, he's been confronted before like that. But this individual is one of those guys that just keeps coming at him, And not only him, but his friends, his family,
yeah.
I mean, everybody around
Everyone.
Him. And so there don't seem to be any rules of civility with this individual at all.
Yeah.
Like that, it's all kind of like, you know, gone down the drain. And so, you know, Walt really just doesn't have any, you know, that much of a choice in the matter anymore. He's going to have to deal with this individual one way or another. And, you know, this is a different kind of book in many ways. It's a thriller. It's not really a mystery like that. It's very epic in nature. It's also very foreign, you know, to coin the phrase. Like, you know, Walt's not only out of his, you know, his county, he's not only out of his state, he's out of his country.
Yes.
You know, he's having to, you know, contend, you know, with a situation that's actually in a foreign country. He's not really receiving a great deal of support, you know, from his own government. He's certainly not receiving any support, you know, from the Mexican government. And so he's kind of on his own, you know, in this particular book, you know, without the resources and the background and the, you know, the individuals that he usually counts on in these situations. And so it made for a much more difficult book to write. And I don't know, I guess the way I look at books is kind of like mountains. You know, you can, you know, some mountains are taller than others, like it. And so it'll take you a while to get the momentum up, you know, to
sure.
being able to write, you know, certain books. And I think with this one, of course, you know, I mean, with the ending of Western Star, you can see that it was more than I could contain in one book. You know, by the time you got to the end of the Western Star, you know, there was a dual narrative going on with that one. And then there were portions of the storyline that had to continue on simply because I needed the momentum of one novel to just carry me in
right.
to the next one. And you know, this one, you know, Depth of Winter kind of hits the ground running.
That's a question I had written down anyway, so we'll just get right into it. You really do dive right into the action. From page one,
yep.
Walt is in Mexico.
Yep.
He's trying to find his daughter. He's
yep.
on the adventure. He's on the trail the entire time.
Yep.
And I thought that was a really interesting way to do it. There's no setup. You could have built up to it. So I guess what made you want to just jump right in and just kind of make references to things that may have happened,
well,
but you didn't show any of the buildup and
right.
the kidnapping and that kind of thing. Walt's just there.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, with a thriller like that, you know, you really don't have the luxury of, you know, building up momentum. You really don't have the time, like, to do a lot of expository, you know, in the beginning of the book, you know, because that slows things down.
Yep.
It really, really does. And normally, I really enjoy that type of thing. I really enjoy, like, dealing out those, you know, those cards,
sure,
you know,
sure.
those plot cards
yep.
one by one. But in this one, I definitely knew that, okay, you know, with the situation being as dire as it is, Walt is not going to be open to the idea of, you know, a slow, you know, moving, you know, investigation like that to
sure.
find out where his daughter is and what it is that's going to happen. He needs to be hitting the ground right away like that. And that kind of predicated the entire structure of the novel to a certain extent.
Great, great. And so I was thinking about the title of it. Anyway, as to kind of slowly work backwards a little bit, The Depth of Winter felt like, I think the average person, as they walk up and see it, they're going to assume it takes place in a snowy, wintry environment. And now that your books do take on the seasons, and this kind of takes place in a winter season.
Oh, yeah.
But clearly, it's not in a snowy environment. It's
oh.
almost, there's a layer of irony to the title.
Oh, absolutely.
He's down in Mexico in the heat.
Absolutely.
This whole thing.
Well,
so how did the title come about?
Well, you know, I get emails from people, like, you know, on a periodic basis. Like, they'll write me emails, and they'll say, there's a lot of snow in your books. You know, and I'm like, well, I don't live in Key West.
No,
you know, like,
a lot
so.
Of snow in
Wyoming. You know, we have like two seasons in Wyoming. We have winter and the 4th of July, and sometimes flurries on the 4th of July. Like, and so with that, like, and as you said, like, there's a kind of a seasonal kind of structure to the books, like, and this was going to be the winter book.
Yep.
And so when I stumbled, you know, across that Albert Camus quote, that even I was surprised to discover that even in the depths of winter, I held within me an eternal summer, like that. It touches on a number of different bases. First of all, like, it was a little bit of a curveball, like, to the readers,
because
I figured they would probably think, okay, this is the winter book and it's depth of winter, boy, this is going to be one cold book.
Yeah.
Okay, and as it turns out, it never gets below 92 degrees. No. I don't think. And then the other one is that it kind of speaks a little bit to the humanity aspect of the books, you know, and I mean, and certainly to Walt, like, I mean, in this book in particular, Walt is facing off, you know, with this drug cartel in northern Mexico, and these are absolutely ruthless individuals.
Yeah,
I mean, brutally violent individuals, like that, with not, you know, much of a sense of humanity, like that. And the question becomes, you know, how can you go up against individuals like that and still retain your own humanity, still retain what it is that makes you, you know, a decent human being, like that, but still, you know, be capable of, like, you know, stopping them in their tracks.
Right.
And so that became one of the major questions, you know, within the book, I think, you know, is does Walt walk away from this, you know, unscathed, or
does he
walk away, you know, perhaps, you know, maybe a little bit harmed, like in some way.
How much like them does he have to become to defeat them?
Exactly.
Exactly. So I actually, just a pure curiosity there, I won't give away any of the details, but how did you, some of the more vicious things that the cartel members are said to have done to victims,
mm-hmm.
there's a couple in particular that I can think of, but did you research those and find out that those things actually happened? Did you just go to the darkest place in your mind?
I don't know if my mind is capable of summoning up, like, at what these guys can do, like that. And I started doing a lot of the research, like, at a lot of the Guardian newspapers, like, it have, you know, a lot of, like, really detailed information, you know, about, you know, some of the things that these guys have done. And it just is blood curdling.
Yeah.
It's literally blood curdling. Oh, my
goodness.
Like that. And, you know, the beheadings and liquefying people in 55-gallon drums. Like that. I mean, they're just, it's some of those horrific things you've ever heard of. I mean, it sounds like it's coming out of, like, you know, something from, like, you know, ancient, you know, history or something. The brutality of it. Like that. And it kind of makes sense, though, like that, because, I mean, Tomas Bedard is a monster among monsters. I think it is that, you know, Martinez says.
Mm-hmm.
Like that here is an individual who has found a home, like that. That this is the perfect environment for him.
He's carved out a home.
Him.
Like, he was somehow.
Yes.
He
was worse than all of the guys that were there,
like
that. And so that just kind of gives you an indication of, you know, what it is that, you know, that Walt's going to have to go up against, you know. But it's, you know, I mean, Tomas Bedard made the mistake of taking Walt on in Absaroka County one time, you know, when he had, you know, both Vic and Henry, you know, for backup, you know, and all of his jurisdictional applications, you know, and all of his resources. And it didn't end well for Tomas Bedard. Like, it didn't at all. Like, and so I think, you know, he learned from that mistake and thought, okay, you know, we're going to have to be in a different kind of environment.
Home field advantage.
Yep.
For the next
exactly.
If there's going to be the ultimate confrontation. He wants it to be on his
exactly.
ground. And he certainly seems like he has set up his own little world and
fortress
to do that.
Oh,
sure.
Yeah.
For sure. So Walt is definitely walking into the lion's den mm-hmm. to try to resolve the conflict of the novel.
Here. I'm afraid so.
But you did touch on something that I absolutely want to talk about, because I love the fact that you start each book with a quote.
Mm-hmm.
I've always enjoyed that. My previous life writing some screenplays, I used to love doing that
uh-huh.
too. So I wanted to ask you specifically, give me the chicken and the egg scenario here. At what point sometimes do you find the quote and that influences the title of the book, or are you writing along and you come up with a title and then you start maybe looking for a specific quote? Or what point in the process do you find these quotes that seem to work so perfectly with the novel?
Well, thank you. Look, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, sometimes, you know, it is that, you know, you have such a strong sense of, like, what the book is about, you know, which is always the big indication there. I mean, you know, I never want to write books where I'm just, like, you know, stacking up bodies like cordwood. You know, I want to have a message that I'm trying to get across. And so if you do have that message, it sensitizes you to, like, you know, quotes and information like that that might, you know, coincide, you know, with whatever that philosophy might happen to be, like that. But then again, it's also a situation where, you know, you'll stumble across one that just sounds just so perfect that you have to use it.
Sure.
The second one, you know, that's used, I think it's the Porfirio Diaz quote.
Yeah, we've actually got the books right here.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and rather than, like, you know, bastardize it, like, it'll probably just have you read it.
Yeah,
like,
there it is. Poor Mexico, so far from God and so near the United States.
There you go.
That's a great one. That's a great one.
And I don't think there's any character that maybe more, you know, is more emblematic of that than the seer, like that, who is the character that Walt meets in the very first, you know, scene of the book. Like, here's a man who has been poisoned by thalidomide, lost his legs, he's a hunchback, he's blind, like that, but he's still referred to as the seer,
like that.
So evidently there's more to him than meets the eye, but it kind of gives you a little bit of an indication of, you know, the kind of borderland situation that Walt finds himself in. Very colorful characters, very different type of characters, and a different, you know, world too. Like, I think there's a point in time when Walt's actually in the desert, like that, and talking about the desert, you know, and finds it surprisingly comforting. So finds it surprisingly, you know, he likes it, like that he actually likes the desert.
It couldn't be more foreign from where he grew
up, but
he feels somewhat at home there.
I think so. I think also, like, this, the natural quality of it. It's not, you know, he certainly doesn't, you know, it doesn't feel at home, you know, with what's going on as far as, like, the society is concerned or the business is concerned or anything like that, but he can still look at the beauty of the landscape of Mexico and still appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you somewhat referenced this a second ago, so we'll wrap up with a couple of last quick questions here. We know you're pressed for time as you got to keep a schedule here. So I was enjoying the little flashbacks that you worked in here.
Mm-hmm.
We get to see a little bit of the early life of Walt and Katie. I initially thought when I got to the first one, I thought, oh, I wonder if this is going to be another kind of parallel book where we're going to bounce back and forth and see some more of Walt's early life. And so I was kind of, I won't give anything away to the readers of it, but I was pleasantly surprised by the way you did that. There's a couple different flashbacks of different things throughout the novel that I really liked. So I wanted to at least throw that out there.
Thank
to
you.
Say that I appreciated that point and to see, I liked the way you used them to not explain to the reader exactly how you did, but what prompted the little flashbacks with Katie, and then there's a small one with Vic with the confrontation with Tomas.
Right. I think a lot of it has to do with just, you know, how it is that the human mind works. A lot of times, like that, you know, we work on a very visual, visceral sense. Like that. And I guess the way that I looked at those little excerpts was almost like snapshots. You know, whenever you think about, especially about people that you care about, you know, family, you know, or people that you, you know, have a strong emotional tie to, like that, you know, you just, it's very visual. Like that, you see them, you know, and you even see them the way they were, you know, whether it was, you know, 40 years ago or 30 years ago or 10 years ago, it doesn't really matter. And it's kind of nice, like that, to have those little ideas like that, because in a book like this, you know, obviously one of the greatest motivations that Walt has into weighing into this, you know, this world, you know, that's completely alien to him, is that his daughter is you know, really kind of up for grabs here, like that. He has no choice at this point, you know. Bedard set up a situation where Walt really, he really doesn't have any choice, like that. He's got to go get his daughter back, like that. Well, it's very easy to just see, you know, Katie as some sort of MacGuffin, you know, as some sort of prop device or something like that, and forget that she's a human being that's very, very important to Walt, you know, that it's, you know, essential, you know, to Walt, you know, Walt's life. And so, you know, for me, that was a way of trying to reinforce that, you know, with the reader so that they could see, you know, just how much she meant, you know, to Walt, you know, as they worked their way through the book.
Because she does spend a good portion of the book as the name that's being chased after.
Yeah.
We don't get to see her very much, obviously.
Well, yeah. I mean, the books are written in first person, like it, and so it would have been, you know, it would have been quite a reach, like that, to suddenly change, you know, and have, you know, Katie's, you know, view of what was going on or something. I haven't done that, you know, in 14 novels, you know. I mean, I kind of let Walt be the voice, you know, of the novels, like it. And so I thought, you know, okay, well, then maybe those snapshots wouldn't be such a bad idea.
This is a way to work her in there.
Yeah, I think so. I think it worked. I hope it did.
It certainly has for me. So the last thing I want to bring up was just a fun one. We'll kind of end on a light, more lighthearted note. I love the Bob Lilly stuff. Bob Lilly ruse cracked me up for the entire time. So I guess if I'm gonna phrase a question in here. Why Bob Lilly? How did Bob Lilly become the choice,
you know,
for this device?
When you've got a 6'5", 260-pound white guy like down in central Mexico or northern Mexico, he's going to kind of stand out, you know. And it was really kind of a difficulty because, you know, what are you going to do with that guy? How are you going to – you can't – you know, he's big, he's white, like, and he's going to stick out like a sore thumb. And so, you know, when the seer comes up with the first idea is that they're going to go on a safari, like for antiquities, you know, weapons. Like, they're just going to find old weapons. Well, then, you know, Walt has too high of a persona. I mean, you know, the federal governments of both, you know, the United States and Mexico are looking for him.
Yes.
And so, you know, whenever this group of, you know, of individuals, police officers like that finally come to the cathedral and they got it surrounded basically and Walt can't get away. the seer comes up with another idea.
Yeah.
And the idea kind of comes from the fact that they happen to have an old gym bag that a border guard, you know, a border patrol guy gave to Walt, you know, to carry a bunch of old weapons in. And it happens to be a Dallas Cowboys duffel bag. Like, and it kind of made sense because I thought, you know, okay, Walt's, you know, entry point, you know, into Mexico is Juarez, you know, right from El Paso.
Yeah.
And so I just thought, okay, well, you know, who would be, you know, who would be a good... you know, who would be a good, you know, good Dallas Cowboy for Walt to be mistaken,
be
you know, for?
Roughly the right age. Obviously
has
the right
to be
size,
a guy who's long retired, like that, you know, and, you know, so that if he doesn't look exactly like he did in his playing days.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like that. And I started doing just a little, it was very cursory research, like it, but the first thing, I mean, the first guy that I even thought of, I think, might have been Bob Lilly because, you know, he was big, he was huge, like it. And I remember, I can't remember Reeves, I think it was. Like it was a wide receiver, and he was the coach for the Broncos.
Dan Reeves.
And there was a story that he used to tell, like that, about Bob Lilly, about how he was like just this big slab of meat, you know, that all these guys, you know, really worked out all the time, and they had all of this, you know, muscle definition and all this kind of stuff. And Bob Lilly just didn't have any muscle definition at all, but he could pick up the other 10 guys on the team and throw them across the field. Like, and I thought, well, that's kind of how I see Walt to a certain extent. And then when I read, you know, that he was like 6'5" and that he weighed 255 pounds, I was like, well, there it is.
That's
perfect.
Walt.
Like, that's got to be him. Like, and so that's when Walt started signing little plastic footballs in Mexico.
I loved it. I thought it cracked me up, but I thought it was great. And then, yeah, obviously it ties into the Dallas Cowboys being the most prominent franchise tour.
Oh, yeah. I mean, right. Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, I figured it was probably something in that line.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know if you were like...
I can't wait to hear what Bob Lilly has to think about this.
I was going to think about it being disguised. I think it's fantastic. And I was kind of curious. I didn't know if you would go with a Denver Broncos since Walt's a Broncos fan. That's why I wasn't sure. And I couldn't, like, Carl Mecklenburg.
Oh, yeah.
I could have,
but you know,
it
had to be right down there on the Mexico border, and I thought, God, it'd probably be Dallas. Yeah, probably has to be.
So I loved it. So we'll wrap it up there. We don't want to give too much away. We talked about a little detail, but there's still a whole lot more in the book. So please go check it out. You can do like I do, and certainly download the audiobook. George Guidel has not lost a step.
Oh, no.
He's still fantastic.
No.
He's still at the top of his game, so I would encourage you to check that out.
He is.
Or certainly run to your independent bookstores and pick up a copy.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate it.
Oh,
we'll see
my
you down
pleasure.
The road again, I'm sure.
We will.
Talk to you later.
Okay.